the program concludes. It's my pleasure to introduce today's instructor, Karen Brosi. Karen Brosi, a sole practitioner, has been based in Palo Alto, California for more than 20 years. She's a certified financial planner and is enrolled to practice before the Internal Revenue Service. Ms. Brosi was a senior tax specialist and director of financial planning before forming her own practice. She specializes in high income, high net worth individuals. Now please welcome Karen Brosi.
Yay, good morning. Oh, good morning. Good morning to those of you in the room here with me today. I like that. I like to see smiley faces in the room. And welcome to those of you who are joining us on the webcast today. It's all about real estate today. And we are just going to go through everything that I ever thought I knew about real estate and real estate taxation. Now, I always have to start this course with a reminder of something that was in my bio that was just read. And that is that my practice is and has been for actually now more than 25 years in Palo Alto, California, right in the heart of the Silicon Valley. But Palo Alto is one of those crazy, stupid places when it comes to the value of real estate. Palo Alto is one of those places that I used to affectionately call it the home of the $1 million starter home. I can't call it that anymore, because it's now the home of the $1.5 or $2 million starter home. That is a three-bedroom, two-bath, 30-year-old ranch-style house will sell for $1.5 million. So when I get ramped up and get to talking about real estate, occasionally these dollar amounts come out of my mouth. So just please forgive me on that I have a bit of a skewed idea of what real estate is actually worth. Now, I actually do know that outside of Palo Alto, other parts of California also have those kinds of values, but other parts of California do not. Although, I was in my car driving here to the training center this morning, and I had the radio on. And that was because my newspaper did not arrive before I had to leave this morning. So I had the radio on, and the radio person was going through some news headlines, and she said, "Oh, we are," and she said, "San Jose, first place in the country to have a median price for homes of over $1 million. And I thought, really? San Jose? Because I know that that's a very different, varying market down there, that they've got the highs and the lows. So I thought that was very interesting that, yeah, real estate and its values. So that's our subject today. Where we're headed can be framed by where I started on pages 1 and 2 in your manual. Now, let me just point out a couple of things about your manual. There is nothing on the slides that you're looking at that is not already in your manual. So you're not missing anything by not having the slides. You have the manual instead. And on the slides, in the upper right-hand corner of every slide, it's a little, I don't know, house-shaped thing that has a number in it, and that number does represent the page number in the manual that I'm on. So if we ever get separated from one another, you can find me by looking at the page number on the slide in the upper right-hand corner. When I was originally drafting this material, I thought, okay, I wanted to be all about real estate. Real estate is something I do a lot of in my practice, and I thought, oh, I know, I'll just start with those quick questions that come in the office, because it seems like it's forever. You know, the phone rings, client on the other end, I have a quick question for you, Karen. And among those quick questions are always things about real estate, buying real estate, financing real estate, selling real estate. All of those things are in there. So I just started on a blank page, and I just started making a list of the kinds of things that my clients have been asking. Now, I'm not going to spend any time this morning on that list, because hopefully by the time we're finished today, we'll have answered all of those quick questions somewhere along the way. The way the materials are going to divide up for us today, is we're going to spend our morning talking about residences. So everything from buying to financing to selling our personal residences. And some of the things that folks do with their personal residences, like vacation rentals, like a home office, those kinds of things. We'll spend a little bit of time just with a quick update on foreclosures because they're not over entirely, but we've settled down quite a bit here in California. And then in the afternoon, we're going to turn our attention to investment real estate. And we're going to talk a lot about rental properties, the passive loss rules, everything associated with that. One of the things that our clients are doing more and more often these days, Airbnb or some kind of online rental activity. We have a section on that. And we'll round out our day with 1031 exchanges. And so that's where we should end up as we get to the end of the day today. I always like it when the class is participatory, so that's why I'm delighted there are several of you in the room today. Feel free to ask your questions. But also I want to encourage those of you on the web to feel free to ask your questions as well. Try to get them framed and in quickly because sometimes I jump from subject to subject and then I have to back up to answer a question that comes in on the web, but we'll try to accommodate all of those if we possibly can. So that's where we're headed for the day. Right on page two, however, just a couple of the things of what's new, what's been updated this last year. We had a couple of tax bills in 2015, the highway bill and the transportation bill. And hidden among those were just a couple of things having to do with real estate. The first of these was some increased scrutiny and compliance issues relative to FRPTA. Now, FRPTA is not new. FRPTA is very old. That's the foreign investment in by non-U.S. persons in real estate. So, and tax withholding associated with that. So, FRPTA is not new. But what we found out from TIGTA, that's Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, at the end of 2014, was TIGTA said, you know what, IRS, you are not doing a good job here. You are not following along carefully on sales of U.S. real estate by foreign individuals. You're not making sure, you're not holding people to compliance with the withholding requirements, nor are you following up to make sure that tax returns are filed and taxes are paid. So there was a little additional compliance information relative to FRPTA that was contained in, I believe it was the highway bill last summer in 2015. And then the PATH Act at the end of 2015, that was the Protecting Americans from Tax Hikes. Yeah, I love their acronyms. But the PATH Act right in December also contained a couple of things relative, mostly in this case, relative to REITs, real estate investment trusts. Now, it the few things that were in there were about further defining what constitutes real estate for the definition of real estate for holdings within a real estate investment trust, when you can and cannot do tax-free spin-offs of the real estate within a real estate investment trust. It doesn't work the same way as spin-offs from a corporation. And those rules have been tightened up just a little bit. And the percentage limits were reduced on REIT assets held by a REIT subsidiary. So just a few things that have changed in the REIT laws. I just point them out to you because it's about all I could find that was brand new legislatively relative to real estate. You and I, most of us, the REIT is not our client. Our client is invested, maybe, in a REIT. And so just to know that the focus may have shifted a little bit in terms of what is the income and how the income is defined as a result of some of the changes from last year. So that's what's new legislatively. We're going to then turn to page four. and we're going to start talking about residences. Well, when we start talking about residences, the first thing we want to talk about is buying your principal residence. Now, I don't know, maybe it's just demographically, based upon my own age, it's not my clients who are buying, especially not their first home. My clients may be buying their last home right now, but my clients are not buying their first home. But often what is coming through the door is my client wanting to talk about helping their child buy their first home. And so that's the way the quick question comes in is, you know, mom comes in and says, I want to help little Johnny buy his first home. Well, the first thing that I have to do with that is sort of frame a few more questions, frame the direction we're going, because what does mom really mean when she says she wants to help little Johnny buy his first home? Does she want to help him finance it? Does she want to help him with a down payment? Where are we going? Now, more often than not, it's that down payment that we're looking for. And that's what mom really means by saying she wants to help little Johnny buy his first house, because what she knows is with the crazy stupid prices of real estate these days and post the housing meltdown in 2008, I always like to say that if you've been in the business long enough and dealt with enough mortgage lenders, you know that mortgage lending sort of runs in cycles. And the cycles that I'm talking about in mortgage lending sort of go like this. They start out basically with rules of who they'll lend to, what the restrictions are, you know, equity, debt versus equity, amount of debt versus income, all of those kinds of things. And that's sort of the standard, the norm in the industry. And then, of course, what happens is that mortgage lenders want to loan more money. And so they start relaxing the rules and relaxing the rules and further relaxing the rules, you know, until you get into kind of that norm that we saw between, 2003 and 2008, about a 5-year period where you basically could buy a house without ever putting a nickel into it yourself. And, you know, they were doing these 20-10-10 loans and 90-10 loans, and, it was worse than that. It was, they were interest-only loans, and they were adjustable rates, and blah. And, of course, the lenders got themselves into trouble, big trouble, doing that sort of thing. And so then what happens is they get into big trouble and then they tighten everything up again. And they go back to what we know is the norm. You got to have a 20% down payment. We'll finance 80%, but only if your income meets certain very careful restrictions on that, et cetera. So that's kind of where we are. That's the place in the life cycle that we are right now. So it is hard, particularly for a young person starting out who may very well have a reasonable salary or a reasonable income these days, but particularly in my area in the Silicon Valley, where engineers, qualified engineers, make a reasonable living wage. They may have the money to pay a mortgage, but they haven't yet had enough time to amass a down payment, particularly on the scale that we're looking at. So that's what mom wants to do. Mom wants to help little Johnny with down payment money. Now, she says, I want to help him. I'm going to give him the money. Well, actually, she's got a couple of choices. She can give him the money. She can just give it to him outright. Mom says, well, you know, I don't want to help him that much. Maybe I want to loan him the money. Now, unfortunately, we are in that environment where loaning him the money may disqualify him from qualifying for a mortgage, right? Because lenders don't like you to borrow everything these days. And so we have to have that discussion of certainly you could loan him the money, but I think you need to be careful about making sure that he qualifies for the underlying mortgage. Sometimes mom will say, oh, I don't even want to do that. Okay, I know that's a problem. I can't loan it to him. I don't want to give it to him outright. I'll just own the home with him. And, you know, then we got to have discussions about that you have an equity interest. How are you going to structure that? And somehow the parent who's in front of me who thinks we're going to do some sort of equity share arrangement, I'm going to own that home with my kid for the money that I've put in, somehow they think there are going to be tax deductions surrounding that. And normally the answer is no, there aren't. It's not going to actually work the way you want it to. And it can get further complicated if there are other children in the family, those kinds of things. And so more often than not, we come back to the first idea. Just give them the money. So I kind of push mom along that way. Okay, look, here's what we're going to do. You're just going to give him the money. So she says, well, okay, but what does that cost me? And I said, well, it doesn't really cost you anything to give him the money. And in fact, so long as you don't exceed the annual gift tax limit, we don't even have to file a return. What do you mean file a return? Well, you can give him $14,000. That's the annual gift limit right now. You give him more than that, we have to file a tax return. It doesn't cost you any tax, says I, and I'm very careful about mentioning that it doesn't cost her any tax, because it will cost her something for me to prepare a gift tax return, won't it? But it doesn't cost her any tax, and she'll use some of her lifetime gift exclusion. Now, some of my wealthier clients, you know, what's the gift, the lifetime gift exclusion? It's north of $5.4 million, right? And so I'm thinking, oh, that's okay, you'll just use some of your lifetime gift exclusion. And the last time I said that to one of my wealthier clients, she said back, what's the lifetime exclusion? And I said, $4.5 million. And she said, oh, that's a problem. Okay, that's a problem. Don't want to use that lifetime gift exclusion. So she doesn't want to file a tax return. She didn't want to pay me to file a gift tax return. She doesn't want to use her lifetime gift exclusion. Okay, $14,000. That's what you can give Johnny. Now let me see. $14,000, if we're aiming for a 20% down payment, $14,000 would be a $70,000 house. I don't even think you can find one of those. I don't think that exists. So I go, oh, wait, Mom, will Dad join in and give to little Johnny? Sure. Okay, now we're at $28,000, $140,000 house. Maybe. Not here, but maybe. All right, maybe not a house that Mom wants little Johnny to live in. Then I got one more question. Why is Johnny buying this new? Why is Johnny so hot to buy his first house? Well, because he just got married to little Susie. Now, before I make the next statement, I got to ask one more question. Do you like little Susie? If you like little Susie, then Mom and Dad can, of course, join together and give to both little Johnny and little Susie. Now we're up to $56,000. We're at a $280,000 home, which, if you don't mind commuting from Modesto, will probably work for you, even here in the Bay Area. So we're close. We're closing in on it. Now, I can go one more step. If they haven't found the ideal home yet, I can say to Mom, okay, we got one more possibility. We can double that $56,000. We can get it to $112,000, but we need 2 days. We just need the right 2 days. You and Dad can give to little Johnny and Susie $56,000 on December 31st, turn around the next day, give them another $56,000, and we have, in fact, avoided using any of your lifetime exclusion, staying within the annual gift tax exclusion amount. So, yeah, there are ways to do that, ways to get the gifting done. Occasionally, I will see some sort of documented loan that ultimately is going to be forgiven. Those are a few of the planning ideas that we see in here. Now, when it comes to financing the purchase of your house, starting on page 5, here's where we sort of dive into Code Section 163. We're going to just sort of fall into Code Section 163, which is everything about where and when interest is deductible on a tax return. And so, because presumably if we did it right, and they don't always, if we did it right, we're going to be able to deduct our home mortgage interest. So that's what 163 is about. On page 5, 163 starts with the very basics. What does it take to be able to deduct qualified mortgage interest? Three steps. I got to be filing a 1040 and itemize my deductions. Okay. Step number 2, I have to be legally liable for the debt. That should also say, and make the payments. Legally liable for the debt and make the payments. And then step number 3, the loan must be secured with a qualified residence. So those are the three things that we're looking for. These are sort of the immutables in 163 when it comes to deducting qualified mortgage debt. Now, we don't have to spend any time on number 1, but I do want to spend some time on number 2 and 3. Starting with number 3, what is a qualified residence? Well, a qualified residence is a residence that I live in that I don't rent out entirely at fair market value. That's a qualified, but it has to be a residence that I live in. I can have up to 2 of those at any given time. So I have a main home, and that's what 163, that's the term Code Section 163 uses, is main home. And they use that term because it implies I can only have one of those at any given time, a main home, and I can have a second home. Now, what happens with the taxpayer who has way too many houses? They have a main home, we can identify their main home. Which is their second home? Well, the truth is a taxpayer gets to pick which one they're going to call their second home. Now, once they've picked, they are sort of stuck with that choice unless they have an intervening event. But the intervening event can be a pretty broad concept. So let me draw an example in the air. My client, whose main home is in Palo Alto, he owns 2 other residences that he never rents out. He and his family use them personally. That's it. He owns a residence in Palm Springs, and he owns another residence in Lake Tahoe. So 3 residences. So the question is, Palo Alto is clearly his main home. Which of the other 2 is his second home? He picks. And of course, mostly we pick the one with the highest interest that still fits within the mortgage debt limits, right? So that's what we pick. Now, can we change? Needs an intervening event. Now, the most obvious is, let's say what we picked was the Lake Tahoe house as the second home. So if there is any financing on Palm Springs, we can't do anything with that because we've already got 2 houses. Now, the most obvious is he sells the Lake Tahoe house and doesn't replace it with anything. Now, at that point, that's clearly an intervening event that'll allow us to flip over and start using any debt that's on Palm Springs as second home. Doesn't have to be that obvious, however, for an intervening event. Truth is, he could sell Palm Springs, which is a nothing right now on his tax return, and replace it with a property in Maui that he finances. That's an intervening event that would allow him to stop using Lake Tahoe as his second residence and change it over to Maui as his second residence. He could, in fact, sell Palo Alto, his main home, and move into Lake Tahoe. That's another obvious one. Moves into Lake Tahoe, and then we could call Palm Springs his second home. So lots of various intervening events are possible to change what it is we're calling as our second home. But I only get 2 of them. I get a main home and a second home. I'm going to do the dollar limits at the very end of this section on Code Section 163. But you basically get to pick which is your second home. Don't get to change unless there's an intervening event. Now, has to be a qualified residence, which basically says that I'm living in it. I'm living in it as either my main home or I'm using it as a second home. So, but what about construction? What about construction? This is the one that always kind of bothers me, because what my client actually has is a main home in Palo Alto. He is building his dream second home in Lake Tahoe. But if any of you have ever dealt with a building contractor, you all know that it's the bottom line answer is that it's going to turn out to be double the money and double the time. Just basically the way it works. So the contractor says, sure, we'll have this house finished in 22 months. Well, that's good, because while it's being built, it's not a home at all, right? Can't live in it because it's being built. Can he still deduct the interest that he's paying on the construction loan? And the answer is yes, for 24 months. What happens at the end of 24 months if he can't move in? Well, the only terrible thing that happens at the end of 24 months if he can't inhabit the property is he has to stop deducting interest. So you get 24 months worth of interest, then you have to stop unless you can actually move into the property. So under that concept of it's going to be double the money and double the time, here's my challenge to you under 163. Now, I have actually been raising this challenge in front of CPE audiences for about 4 years now. No one has found me a site that contradicts this. When Code Section 163 says you get a 24-month construction period, it doesn't say which 24 months. Now, when I start a construction project building a new home, I don't draw all the money at once, right? Because heaven forbid, I'm not paying the contractor all at once. I'm gonna only draw on the construction loan as I pay the installments to the contractor, which means the first amount of interest should be a lot less than the last amounts of interest just before the home is completed. So if I already know that my contractor's lying to me, that there's no way we're gonna be finished in 24 months, what if I don't start deducting interest from the first interest paid? What if I wait and absorb that cost as non-tax deductible in the hope, in the idea that I will in fact be able to deduct the larger amounts later when the time frame runs over? So I've asked this question everywhere. I've researched 163. I don't see anything that says it has to be the first 24 months. So, just a concept. Yes, sir.
And if he finishes in 24 months, you can go back and amend your return.
Yeah, we're still open under the statute. Very good. That if, in fact, I waited, say, 6 months, and then started deducting the interest, and my contractor surprised me and finished, you know, right on time, now I've only deducted 18 months of the construction loan, but I'm still under the statute to go back and amend the returns, you bet. So, yeah, I like that idea as well. All right, so that's construction phase on the loan. So that it's got to be secured by qualified residents. Then it has to be qualified debt, which means that was condition number two. Remember, I filed a 1049 itemized. I have to be legally liable for the debt and pay it, and it has to be secured by qualified residents. So this is that number two, that I have to be legally liable for the debt. Code Section 163 has always said that I must be legally liable for the debt and make the payments in order to deduct it. Now, taxpayers have sort of moved this concept along a little bit about what it really means to be legally liable for the debt, because you and I would say you got to be on title to the property and you got to be the named borrower on the loan. That makes you legally liable for the debt. Well, in fact, there's been just a host of case law in this area of legally liable for the debt. And it's the tax court, believe it or not, who have pushed the bar out a little bit on what constitutes legal liability for the debt. And we've seen it as sort of a transition over time through the tax court rulings. And what the tax court is now coming down to is something called a burdens and benefits of ownership test. Burdens and benefits of ownership. So what does that mean? Well, let's start by actually, I actually have a list on the bottom of page 8 of what the tax court has been using of burdens and benefits of ownership. But let's look at a little bit of the case law. Starting all the way back with the Golder case. Now, the Golder case should have been a non-starter for the IRS because the Golder case, the Golders were the homeowners. They were named on the debt, but the debt was something that we've come to know too well, the meaning of over the last several years. The debt was a non-recourse loan. Now, you and I know that basic concept of non-recourse says if I default, the lender can only come take the property from me. They have no recourse to come satisfy any remaining debt directly from me. And the IRS at one time wanted to say, well, a non-recourse debt then doesn't make the borrower legally liable for the debt. Yeah, and the tax court said, you're kidding, right? Get out of here. So that was the basic concept in the Golder case. Now, the Song case went one step further. Now, we won't see this anymore. We haven't seen this combination in a long time, since the last time, before 2008, this would have been in the early 90s, when lenders got in trouble loaning too much money to the wrong people. The Song fact pattern was the Songs were on title to the loan, but they lacked sufficient credit history in order to qualify for the debt. So they got a relative to come in and co-sign the loan for them. What's the part that we won't see like that anymore is that mostly when lenders reject you these days on the purchase of real estate because of credit history or whatever, they will not let you be on title to the property. They will only let the borrower that they accept be on title to the property. That wasn't the case with the Songs. The Songs actually had ownership in part of the property. Yes, there was. They did name the co-borrower, the co-signer, as on title to the property as well. But it was the Songs' house. The Songs were not named as borrowers anywhere on the loan. So they were not on the loan, they were on the title, they made all the payments on the property. And the IRS wanted to say, nope, not on the loan, not legally liable for the debt, not deductible. And the tax court, this was the first instance where the tax court started to build burdens and benefits of ownership. To say, you know what, this is their house. The very fact that it is their residence creates a burden of ownership. That forces them to be legally liable to pay that debt, because if they don't, they lose something very valuable. That is their home and any equity that they had put into that home. So the Songs win in the tax court, never named on the loan, but on title to the property. Now, it took a bunch of taxpayers and a whole bunch of years to get to the next logical progression in this step, which would be, can I, on my own residence, neither be on title nor a named borrower on the loan? Nevertheless, I make all the payments, and it is my house that I live in. Can I deduct that? And that's the Ouzlou case. And the Ouzlou fact pattern, let's see, I just want to remember, yeah, Ouzlou is, boy, it's going on 20 years. It was a 1997 tax court decision. Now, the fact pattern in Ouzlou was this. Ouzlou was new to this country. He was a recent immigrant, he, his wife, and his children. He had down payment money when he entered the country. He had enough down payment money, and he almost immediately had a job. So he had income, and he had down payment money. He had no credit record at all. There wasn't a lender on the planet that would loan to him. But Uzlu had something else. Uzlu had a brother whose name I can never remember, so I just call him Brother. Brother had come to this country several years before Uzlu and his family. So Brother was long established here with a credit rating, his own home, all of that. So Uzlu gives the down payment money to his brother. And he picks out a house, and the brother uses the down payment money, qualifies for a loan, closes title in brother's name only. So the title is only in brother's name. Brother is the only named borrower on the loan. Nevertheless, Uzlu and his family move into the property. Uzlu makes all the mortgage payments, all the property tax payments. He insures the property. He begins to do improvements on the property and deducts the mortgage interest payments. And, of course, the IRS comes in all kind of crazy on that. No, we draw the line. That is not legally liable for the debt. Your name isn't anywhere on this. And Uzlu goes to tax court. Now, personally, I believe that the Uzlu case as a landmark decision in burdens and benefits of ownership, I believe Uzlu brought something that was very important with him to tax court. He brought Brother with a signed affidavit. And Brother signed under penalty of perjury, "This is not my house. In fact, I've never even entered this property except as an invited guest of Uzlu. I have no ownership interest at all. I have paid not one cent out of my own pocket towards this property. My Uzlu is making all of the mortgage interest payments. And in fact, if he ever stops making the mortgage payments, I don't care. I won't help him. He can lose the house for all I care." And under that testimony and that signed affidavit, the tax court said, "Good enough for us. Burdens and benefits of ownership, Uzlu wins. Not on title, not a named borrower on the loan." Now, the Uzlu case, because it's a 1997 case, at the time I read it, I thought, ooh, that is the one we've been waiting for. But of course, the other thing that I thought as a practitioner was, never going to happen to me. Not going to recommend this as a strategy to anyone because, you know, I don't ever want to see Brosi v. Commissioner on any document. I continue to mind my own business, do my own practice. My practice, I was with a CPA firm in downtown Palo Alto for the first several years of my career. And then in 2004, I moved out and started my own practice. I did that in August of 2004. I can always remember the date because it was exactly 1 month before Google went public in 2004. And as it happened, because of course I was hungry and I was out there looking and I have a particular specialty in stock options, I attracted a bunch of Google employees on sort of every level because, by the way, Google, it appears, gave stock options to everybody, including the janitor, at one point. Incentive stock options. Well, among the varying strata of Google personnel that I was advising at that time was a young woman who was an accounts payable clerk at Google. And yes, she had stock options. She was single. And she came to me because she said, "Look, here's what I want to do. This is not a lot. This is not the stratosphere of stock options. But it's a lot of money to me, and it's enough money that I want to be able to buy a house. So I want you, Karen, to help me liquidate these stock options in an organized, tax-efficient manner so that I can buy a house." So I did that. I consulted on it. I advised her how to do it. I prepared her tax returns for the year in question, which was 2004, 2005. She buys the house. 2006, she gets married. I thought, that's nice, and I kept doing her tax return. 2007, she comes in for her tax interview for the 2007 tax year, and she brings me two 1098s. Now, even I can figure out that you have two 1098s, you probably refinanced your mortgage. So I said that out loud to her. "You did a refi." She said, "Well, yeah, we had to, because eventually we had to get my sister's name off of everything because I had bad credit, and I've been working to clean it up. I didn't qualify for the mortgage. And, you know, note to self, read the 1098s when they come in. Sure enough, she was not on title to the property for those previous 3 years. She was not the named borrower on the loan. Her sister and brother-in-law were. And they had refinanced in the middle of 2007 so that they could take the sister and brother-in-law off and they could move forward. She and her husband could move forward. And, of course, so note to self, read the 1098s. And then, of course, the next thought that went through my mind was, how long does till the statute of limitations runs out on this, right? Well, I didn't make it, by the way, because sure enough, the IRS audited mortgage interest deduction, but I got lucky. They audited that 2007 year, the year of the refinance. So I only asked my client for two things that I didn't already have. I had the two 1098s. I asked her for a copy of the closing statement, what was then called the HUD 1, which they apparently don't call the HUD 1 anymore. So the HUD 1, and I asked her for copies of all of the checks for the year for the mortgage payments. She provided those two things to me. I wrote it up. I cited OOZLU everywhere in my write-up, sent it in. 60 days later, we got a no change letter. And I thought, ooh, it works. Now, I still don't recommend it. It's not the approach that I want to take with my clients. But what I also do know is that I'm testimony that citing the OOZLU fact pattern does, in fact, work. Now, I have a couple of more recent cases in this regard, neither of which are the Coleman case, by the way. But I have two other cases that I have cited for you, starting on page 9. One is the Fan case, and the other is the Luciano Salas case. And these are both from last year, 2015. Now, in the Fan case, he wins. Fan is a young man with an elderly mother who owns a house on some acreage. Fan also has siblings, but Fan agrees to move in with mom because she's not in good health. So Fan agrees that he's going to move into the house with mom. He is going to take care of her. He's going to be in charge of her care. And in exchange for that, by agreement, verbal agreement, with the siblings and with mom, he is going to be given the house after mom is gone. Now, he moves in. He begins taking care of mom. Not only is she in ill health, her finances aren't in the best of shape either. So he starts making the mortgage payments on the property, which by agreement is going to be his house because he's living in it, because he's taking care of mom. He starts making the mortgage payments. He deducts them. Now, he is currently not on title nor on the loan. IRS hates it. Tax court says, same fact pattern, burdens and benefits of ownership. He gets testimony, he gets credible testimony from his family members that the property is considered to be his, even though mom was still alive while he was making the mortgage payments. Fan wins. Luciano, this is Della Rosa Luciano Salas. Della Rosa was living in a house also that she was not on title on. She was not the named borrower. She was, in fact, making the payments, and she could show that she was making the payments. But the title holder, the borrower, was her sister, who it was a little unclear whether the sister was still living there or not. Nevertheless, Della Rosa deducts the mortgage payments that she makes. IRS disallows it, and she loses in tax court. But you want to know why? Because the year before the year in question in Della Rosa's case, her sister had filed for bankruptcy and had named the house as one of her assets in the bankruptcy estate. And the tax court said, you can't have it both ways. Sister can't have it as an asset for purposes of bankruptcy, and you have burdens and benefits of ownership simply because you're living there and making the mortgage payments, so she loses on her deduction. Now, I have a question from the web. Karen, I had a client whose lender convinced him to use the ISOs as collateral. Yes, that's a big mess. That's a big mess in a lot of ways, by the way. Rather than exercising the options, they use the options themselves as collateral. And when the options became less than they went underwater, became worth less than the outstanding amount of the loan. This is an even bigger problem, by the way, where the loan to buy the house is not secured by the house. And in fact, burdens and benefits of ownership, not gonna do all of that. I'm gonna move right to page 10, which is where this question is the problem. Because not only do I have to be legally liable for the debt, and it has to be secured by a qualified resident, under Code Section 163, for this to be mortgage interest, the collateral must be specifically correct. And by that, I mean, if I'm saying it's acquisition debt on my main home, the collateral has to be my main home. If I'm saying that it's acquisition debt for a second home, the collateral has to be my second home. Otherwise, it's not deductible as mortgage interest under Code Section 163. And clients, this is the one the clients mess up all the time, as my person on the webcast clearly saw. Two examples that I have specifically in your materials on page 11. The first is the Boehms. Now, the Boehms had hit the California lottery, and they hit one of those big lottery amounts that isn't going to pay you in a lump sum. It's going to pay you over 30 years in installments. Now, when the Boehms hit the lottery, they already owned a home, and all they didn't want to move. All they really wanted to do was completely remodel their home. I mean, basically, they were taking it down to the studs and the joists and the, you know, but they wanted to completely remodel their home. The only problem that they faced was the amount for the remodel was way more than any single annual lottery payment that they were going to get. So they went to their banker and they said, will you loan us the money to do this construction? We clearly have a stream of income coming in. And the banker agreed and said, yes, you do clearly have a stream of income for the next 30 years. I will gladly loan you the money to remodel your home. But by the way, I will take as collateral for this loan a secured interest in your lottery winnings. Not a deed of trust, not a mortgage against the house, a secured interest in the lottery winnings. The banker was as happy as a clam because he knew he was going to get paid. He loaned them the money. The Boehms were completely happy because they remodeled their house. The only problem came when the Boehms were actually making the annual payments and deducting the interest as qualified mortgage interest. And they said, well, it's acquisition debt on our main home. And the tax court said, yeah, but the collateral's wrong. So no deduction allowed for you because the collateral is incorrect. Now, the second case that I have cited is not actually a tax court case, but it made the news at the time. And it was, this had to have been in the 80s, in the early 80s. It was John Sununu, who at the time was the senator from New Hampshire. This was before he became chief of staff for Bush the First. And so he was still the senator from New Hampshire. He obviously owned a main home in the state of New Hampshire. He wanted to buy a second home in Georgetown. So he borrows using his main home in New Hampshire as collateral to buy the second home in Georgetown. So lender loans him the money, but the collateral is the main home. The purpose of the loan is acquisition of a second home. Is the mortgage interest deductible? No, it's not. Now, in Sununu's case, if he hadn't already used his $100,000 of equity, up to $100,000 could have been deductible by him as home equity debt, but it was never going to be deductible as acquisition debt on the second home because it was not secured by the second home. So that's how specific Code Section 163 is. As my person on the web just discovered, yeah, borrow to buy a house, but use your stock options as collateral, that's not going to be mortgage interest either. Because it's not secured by the residents. Yes, sir.
Two questions. On Boehm, if you had said to the banker, yeah, you want my lottery tickets secured, great. I want you also to take the lien on the house.
Perfect. And the comment up here was, take the Boehm case, for example, and say, sure, you can have a secured interest in my lottery winnings, but I want you also to take a deed of trust against my house. That is the most obvious fix for this, because then the collateral is correct, even though it was a second thought. It's still correct. However, I will give you an example. I had a client. She is no longer my client because I couldn't deduct her interest. I had a client who owned a rental house in San Jose. She had owned it for so long, it was free and clear. No mortgage on it at all. She was buying a second home in El Dorado Hills. She borrowed against the San Jose rental house. That's what the lender took as collateral, gave her the money, she buys the second home in El Dorado Hills. Comes in with all this mortgage interest and says, deduct it. I said, I can't. I said, but I got an out for you. Go back to the lender. Now it's all the dust has settled. Go back to the lender, tell them they can keep the rental house as collateral, and you're gonna give them additional collateral. Give them also a deed of trust secured by the second home. She says, okay, she does that. The lender said, no, we don't know how to do that. That was my one and only experience with a brilliant idea. It is the fix. But I've actually heard that from others who have had the same problem, and the lenders have said after the fact, no, we can't do that. We don't know how to do that.
Because she didn't consult you before doing
well, that. I should have fired her, but if I fired every client who didn't consult me before they closed the transaction, I'd be on permanent vacation. Yeah.
The second question. You've got a rental property, and you've been doing improvements for the last 5 years, let's say. You put on a new roof. You put in $30,000. You put in $25,000 for the key, you know, blah, blah, blah. So you've put in $100,000.
Okay.
And now you go, okay, now I got to put in more. But screw that, I'm not just gonna borrow $50,000. I'm gonna borrow $200,000 and pay myself back for all the improvements I've done for the last 4 years.
Yeah, okay, so the question here is, I got a rental property. Let's just say it's had some deferred maintenance that caught up with me. And over the last couple of years, I've been putting money in. Put $30,000 in 1 year, put another $30,000 in the next year. Now it needs a new roof, and I need to pony up another $40,000 for that. And I say, forget it, I'm not coming out of pocket anymore. This is your question. But I'm not going to just borrow the $40,000 I need right now. I'm going to borrow $100,000 against the property and pay myself back for the amounts that I've paid over the last couple of years. Is it deductible? And the answer to that is probably not. I know that if we're talking about a residence, the answer is no, because the rule is 90 days. 90 days before or after the expenditure. Secure it with the property and you're golden. You know, or take out the loan and pay yourself back. You're golden. On a rental property, I suppose I would argue that tracing. I suppose I would argue that I took that money out of savings. Now, when I borrow it, I'm putting that money back into savings. But the tracing is not that it's investment interest expense, but instead it's tied to the rental property because I used investments to do it originally, and now I'm replacing the investments. I would argue that, I think, and you might be able to win that one on a rental house, but don't do it on a residence.
Tracing rules are very taxpayer-friendly.
Tracing rules can be very taxpayer-friendly. They can also be a little harsh as well. But the tracing rules, and we're going to talk about the tracing rules in just a few minutes. So I just wanted to get that one out because, in fact, that ties to the question that came, is that the collateral, when it's home mortgage interest, the collateral must be specifically correct. So speaking of tracing rules, on page 12, these are the tracing rules. These are also in 163. But the reason why I equivocated when you said the tracing rules are very taxpayer friendly, and I sort of equivocated on that, is because what a lot of folks don't realize is that it's all in 163, the tracing rules and the mortgage interest rules, but they don't actually coincide. They cancel each other out in some cases. So as a for instance, that that if my collateral is, well, no, I don't want to do it that way. If my collateral is not specifically correct, like my client with who borrowed out of the rental property and used it to buy a second home, that's not deductible as mortgage debt because it's not correctly collateralized. And you and I would all agree that I can't deduct it on Schedule E either, on the rental property, because that's where tracing does apply, and she didn't use the money for purposes of the rental property. She used it for personal purposes, so it becomes nothing more than personal interest and not deductible by her. The flip side is also true under Code Section 163, that if I have secured a loan, because 163 basically says, I am really going to finish that sentence pretty soon. 163 basically says, we don't care what the collateral is. What did you do with the money? That was the danger that my client fell into. We don't care what the collateral is. What did you do with the money? Whatever you did with the money. But the exception under 163 is, if the collateral is a qualified residence. So if you have secured this loan with a main home or a second home, a qualified residence, then it's either acquisition debt, equity debt, or it's nothing. Okay, so the mortgage rules come into play the moment you do secure it with a qualified residence. So that's not necessarily good news because, to draw an example in the air, a client has a home, and they also have a sole proprietorship, a small business. The home has equity in it. It has a loan on it. It's got a $400,000 loan that is currently just his acquisition debt. $400,000. He needs $50,000 to buy some new equipment in his business. He goes to the bank. Lender says, absolutely, I'll loan you $50,000. I want to take your house as collateral. By the way, interest rates are so low, let's refinance the house, right? So instead of giving you just a new loan for $50,000, we'll give you a new loan for $450,000. We'll replace your existing first with a new first of $450,000. My client says, okay. He gets, because all he cares about is he gets the $50,000 that he needs to go fund the Schedule C business. What's the problem? Well, it's secured by his main home. And so left alone without any other intervention, that now has to be home equity debt. Is it deductible? Of course it is. But where is it deductible as home equity debt? Schedule A. Where do I want to deduct it? Schedule C above the line, right? I want to reduce AGI, and I certainly want to reduce any potential self-employment taxes for it. Can I do that? Well, I've always been able to do that. That's a election that's available in the regulations at 163.10T. Now, don't be confused by the T part of 10T. This reg is so old that those were the days when they originally came out as a T, temporary, but if nothing happened in like 2 years, they became permanent. The code just didn't change the nomenclature on them. So this is not in any way a temporary regulation. It's a permanent reg at 163.10T. It calls for an election in exactly this case we were just talking about. Calls for an election where if I have secured a loan with a qualified residence, but I want to trace it, I make an election that says, let's pretend that loan's not secured. If we pretend the loan's not secured, now it falls outside of the mortgage interest rules and the tracing rules apply, and I get to deduct the interest wherever I want to. 10T is so old that the biggest question that was out there for years and years and years was this. Can I make a 10T election on part of a loan? Or does it apply to the entire loan when I make the 10T election? Now, it was the great unanswered question for bunches of years, almost 30 years. It was the great unanswered question because the reg didn't actually say that it had to be a separate loan. And lots of us did it, by the way. In exactly the example I just gave you, client had a $400,000 loan on his house, he needed $50,000, the lender refinances, gives him one new loan for $450,000, and we would make the 10T election on part of the loan, the $50,000 only, because obviously we don't want to make the 10T election on the underlying $400,000, because that's telling the IRS, let's pretend it's not secured, now it's not qualified mortgage interest. So I wanted to make the election and did on just the $50,000. Well, the problem with that is back in 2012, it's the bottom of this slide, somebody asked the IRS this question out loud. Actually, in writing. And it wasn't just any somebody, because it came out as a chief counsel advisory, which means it started out internally. Somebody at the IRS asked Washington the question, can you make a 10T election on only part of a loan? And in 2012, chief counsel issued an advisory that said, no. We don't read the regulation that way. You cannot make the 10T election on only part of a loan. So my client who, yes, in your verbiage, should be my former client now because they didn't ask me, when they present me with that new $450,000 mortgage, I'm going to send them running back to the lender and say, take it apart, okay? Leave the $400,000. Take out a second loan of $50,000, I can make the 10T election on the separate loan. I don't care what the banker calls it, by the way. They can call it a HELOC, a home equity line of credit. Doesn't matter what it's called. I just need it to be a separate loan to make the 10T election. Now, that was the stick. That was the bad part that was in the CCA. There actually was a good part for certain clients. Let me just change the fact pattern slightly in the example I've been using. Let's suppose my client already had a $400,000 loan on his house. He needs $50,000 for his Schedule C, but that $400,000 loan on his house, I've been watching it, and it's actually only $300,000 of it is his now original acquisition debt. He has been borrowing, I don't know, to pay something frivolous like his kid's college education, right? And so he's already gotten to $100,000 of equity debt. Now, he's the client who, if he goes in and says to the banker, I need $50,000, and the banker says, let's refinance, and we'll send you out the door with a new $450,000 loan, he'll be okay under this 2012 CCA. And the reason is the chief counsel says, absent any kind of election or separate loan, the assumption that we will follow is acquisition debt up to the actual amount of your acquisition debt. Any borrowing over that that's secured by your home will be considered home equity debt until you reach the home equity limit. Then anything over that, you can trace without an election. So if you have exceeded already your acquisition debt and your home equity debt, you do one of these refinances and use the money for some other purpose that is deductible elsewhere under the tracing rules, you're okay. Everybody else, I gotta have them separate the loans so I can make a 10T election on it. So that's the CCA, that's all on the ensuing pages, 12, 13. 13 talks about how you can actually make the 10T election and what the amount of acquisition debt really is. Now, on page 15, because I mentioned that I was going to get here eventually, is when I finally get to the dollar limits, right? The dollar limits that have been in the law since 1987. 1987 is when, October of 87, actually, is when the dollar limits came into play. And the dollar limits say it's $1 million of acquisition debt plus $100,000 secured by your main residence used but for any other purpose. That's actually directly out of 163. $1 million of acquisition debt in total across two homes, and $100,000 secured by your main residence used for any other purpose. That's the key phrase, any other purpose, because from October of 1987 until just a couple of years ago, the IRS was enforcing that any other purpose rule. And that meant you could only have acquisition debt of $1 million. If you wanted to claim acquisition debt of 1.1, they said no. The 100,000 had to be used for some other purpose. Question or comment here?
Question. We can back up to the tracing part. So let's say you buy a home, and let's say it's $1.5 million that you borrow acquisition debt. But let's say half the home you could split off and make a rental property.
Okay.
Can you deduct interest on 750 on Schedule A and interest on 750 on Schedule E? That's kind of like tracing, but it's not.
Yes, exactly right. So the question is, say you buy a home, you finance $1.5 million in acquisition. But suppose that half the home is structured such that half the home you break out and you rent it out. So that's a rental property. That is actually a bifurcated property with one loan on it. And in that particular case, 280A makes that okay, is what it does. Is it makes that okay that that's a bifurcated property. Part of it is a residence and part of it is a rental property, even though it's only one loan. And so you're not actually making an election at all. Really, you are allocating your expenses to half rental and half personal residence. So,
if you have a home equity line, another lender, and you spend it all on the rental, you don't have to split 50-50 between A.
Yes, but in that particular case, I would be very careful to suggest. So, the next part of the question was: take out $100,000 of equity, use it all on the rental. I would be very specific to make sure I made the 10T election on that, to say the entire $100,000. Is being traced specifically to the rental property, yeah, and not allocated. Because once again, the collateral is a single property. And so we don't like to confuse the IRS.
If you don't make that election, they may say you have to split it 50-50.
They may say you have to split it 50-50 if you don't make the election on that additional loan, yeah.
Which might help you if you have a loss.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so it's about the $1 million, and as I mentioned, the first part of this was from 1987 to just a couple of years ago, the IRS was really, really picky about that $100,000 had to be used for some other purpose than to buy, build, or improve. That's the definition of acquisition debt, buy, build, or improve. My main home or a second home. Finally, however, in 2009, in another chief counsel advisory, the IRS got over themselves on this $100,000. Now, just 2 years before that, they had adjudicated the Powell case, which is actually right here out of the peninsula, the Bay Area. Mr. and Mrs. Powell had bought a home, $2 million, in the Redwood City area. They had financed $1.5 million. They had very carefully allocated and deducted interest on only $1.1 million. And the IRS came through and the tax court agreed in the Powell case, no, the acquisition debt is limited to a million. You had to use the $100,000 for some other purpose. IRS won the Powell case and then just a couple of years later came out with CCA 2009 and said, we take it back. We take it back. You can have acquisition debt to the total $1.1 million. Now, don't forget that if you are allocating $1.1 million of acquisition debt, there is no such thing in your world as a home equity debt. You don't get one additional amount over and above that. So maximum limit, $1.1 million. And in fact, in the CCA, the IRS even mentioned the Powell case and said, we know that flies in the face of what we have long held, but we're going to go with that $1.1 million. It was always really generally the right answer. We always knew that's the way it should have been, and it just took them 20-some years to get to that answer. Now, the other thing that we've known, and that we had known for more than 20 years, going on 30 now, was that 163 for mortgage interest, when it was rewritten in 1987, was in fact a built-in marriage penalty under the law. That it said that I could have acquisition debt to $1 million, on principal residence and a second home in combination. It didn't define the taxpayer, except that it did carefully, and always has in 163, said, but if you are married filing separate, then each of you is limited to $500,000, or what would now be $550,000 of acquisition debt. So since 1987, we have always said, Code Section 163 for mortgage interest, the debt limit is a built-in marriage penalty under the law. Because if I'm a single taxpayer, and John up here is a single taxpayer, and we both buy a house together. We are not related, we are not married, but we both buy a house together. We both move into it together. We both pay 50-50, everything, down payment, mortgage interest, etc. We could have a $2 million mortgage and each be able to deduct the interest on up to $1 million. So we could each, between us on that house, deduct mortgage interest of $2 million. But what happens if John and I get married in that situation? Oh, by the way, John, there'll be really bad results other than tax results if we get married. But if we were to get married, what happens? We're limited to the $1 million of acquisition debt. So we immediately lose half our mortgage interest. How's that for a marriage penalty? Greater Bay Area marriage penalty, or Southern California, because that's the fact pattern in Sophie and Voss. Now, how this started was way back in 2009, once again, somebody decided to ask the IRS this question. In this case, it was a taxpayer in a private letter ruling. And the IRS, in the private letter ruling, said, oh, no, that's not the way we interpret 163. We interpret 163 that mortgage limit goes with the residence, that no matter how many separate taxpayers own the residence, total limit $1 million. That was what the private letter ruling said. We thought, oh, they can't possibly mean that. Well, they followed it up a year later with an actual revenue ruling in 2010. It's 2010-25. And they said, no, we really mean that. That our interpretation of Code Section 163 is that it doesn't matter how many separate taxpayers it is, that $1 million, or now $1.1 million of acquisition debt, goes with the residents. Well, then enter the fray in 2013, Sophie and Voss. Now, Sophie and Voss are two single men who own two residences together. The first of those residences is in Beverly Hills, and the second one is in Rancho Mirage. I pause only because I'm on the web, and that's because everywhere else in the world, I would just say Palm Springs. But you know those people in Southern California, particularly in that area, they care. It matters to them whether it's Palm Desert or Palm Springs or Rancho Mirage. So it was Rancho Mirage. So two houses, main home, second home. The Rancho Mirage home was just a second home. They only ever used it personally. total debt, acquisition debt across the two properties, main home and second home, $2.8 million. They, single individuals, each filing his own separate tax return. They, each one of them, carefully allocated and each deducted mortgage interest of $1.1 million. They were clearly, they could demonstrate everybody, they were splitting all the expenses. Everybody was paying his fair share on those expenses. They each deducted mortgage interest up to $1.1 million. The IRS came through and audited it and disallowed it. Took it back down to $550,000 for each one of them across those two residences. Sophie and Boss went to tax court in 2014. The tax court sided with the IRS in 2014 in this case and said, yeah, we agree because, you know, that's got to be what Congress intended in writing this, that it was per residence. Fortunately for all of us, Sophie and Voss did not quit, and they went to our very own wild and wacky Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2015. And the Ninth Circuit overturned the lower court. Further, the Ninth Circuit was a little irked with the lower court because they actually cited what the lower court's decision was, that, you know, Code Section 163 says a million or 1.1 million, but it very specifically says that if you're married filing separate, that's going to be limited to 550. And that's what the tax court, the IRS, and the tax court used in making their decision in the Sophie and Voss case. And the Court of Appeals said, it doesn't define all separate taxpayers limited to 550,000. It specifically defines married filing separate, limited to 550,000. And if you want to extrapolate that across all other separate taxpayers, you need to go to Congress and get a legislative change. And so that's what the Ninth Circuit said. They upheld the deduction of Sophie and Voss of $1.1 million each. That was in 2015. It was only this week, by the way. So the week of whatever this is, the 8th of August, that the IRS has now finally acquiesced on the Voss appeal. They are not going to pursue it. They waited almost a year to acquiesce on it, which means we can expect to see them rescind now revenue ruling 2010-25. But they waited almost a year to acquiesce on that appeal. So that's the mortgage limits. Now, buy, build, or improve, we've talked around a couple of these. We talked about the 24-month construction period. Now, it's also within 90 days of purchase. This is a phenomenon we in the Bay Area have seen, especially in the Silicon Valley. So I cash in my stock options. I got cash. I go buy me a house with that cash, right? Well, because Bay Area real estate prices are so crazy stupid, we are back in the era of bidding wars, multiple offers coming in over asking price, and who's going to get the winning bid? The guy who can close the fastest, right? So we are seeing that phenomenon return of, I got me some cash, I'm going to go buy me a house. Now, I got me some cash, I'm going to go buy me a house, but this is otherwise a relatively young taxpayer with ongoing income. They're not retiring anytime soon. They've got a good job or a couple of jobs in the family, and they've got ongoing taxable income. We'd like them to have some mortgage interest. Now, that's okay if they would talk to me soon enough, because if I can get them within 90 days of the purchase to get into the bank and get closed on a loan secured by that property, we can call it acquisition debt, even though they use their own money. So that was something I hinted at earlier on the question in the room, although the question came relative to having done that with construction on your rental property. But within 90 days of purchase, you can also do that, I know, with your home. If you decided to do a remodel and thought you were going to fund it yourself, and then under the concept of remodels also work this way, double the money and double the time, when you got to the end of it, you went, wow, I don't have any savings left. It all just went to my contractor. And you think, oh, I should have borrowed it. It's one of the phrases I use. I like to tell my taxpayers, my clients, let the house pay for the house. And if you are doing a serious remodel, let's have the house pay for that. And by that, I mean, let's take out a loan. Well, they didn't do that because they, by the way, didn't bother to stop and see me before they started funding it themselves. But if I can get within 90 days of completion on the construction and get the loan on, I can call it acquisition debt. Home equity debt limit, $100,000. Yes, I can use that for anything. And it is still deductible as qualified mortgage interest, but it does have to be properly secured. Now, the problem with home equity debt is not code section 163, it's code section 56 and the alternative minimum tax. Because code section 56, code section 163, by the way, just allows for acquisition debt plus equity debt. Code section 56 only allows for acquisition debt as defined by code section 163. And although the IRS has acquiesced that your acquisition debt can include that extra $100,000, code section 163 still calls that something else other than acquisition debt. And so code section 56 does as well. So if your client has been borrowing out of the equity of their home, using it for some other purpose than to buy, build, or improve that residence, then it is home equity debt, and while it is deductible on Schedule A, it is not deductible on the 6251. I found over the course of time, I had to start capturing this information for a couple of reasons. One is that in my client base, I probably got 65% of my clients are in AMT. Every year. And so if they got equity debt, that's a big deal because they're already in AMT. I need to make sure that we're doing the tentative minimum tax calculation correctly. But I sort of stutter started in getting this going because I started trying to capture this information in the early 2000s from my clients. You know, that was when people were doing two or three refinances a year, chasing a lower interest rate. And I found I was asking the wrong question when, even I could figure out that if they brought me more than 1098, that the chances were good that they had refinanced. So I'd say, you refinanced during the year. The question I was asking that was wrong was, did you take any money out? Because that, I'm looking for the equity debt. Now, of course, they would always say no. And they weren't lying to me, but the reason it's the wrong question is that refinances cost something. So their debt was going up. And if the debt was going up, that was home equity debt, because their acquisition debt was tied to whatever the acquisition debt was immediately before the refinance. So any extra amount that paid for the closing costs, that was home equity debt. And I needed to schedule that out and be paying attention to it for purposes of the 6251. The other problem with code section 56 and home equity debt is the definition of a residence. So under 163, a residence is a house, an apartment building. I don't have that here. A house, an apartment building, a condominium, a townhouse, a mobile home, all of those things are a residence. But also under 163, anything that I like to say has the big three, a bedroom, a bathroom, and a kitchen. You got a bedroom, a bathroom, and kitchen, even if it's not permanently affixed to the land, it's a residence under 163. So that gets you some boats. It gets you those great big RVs that people are buying as a second, potentially as a residence, usually a second residence for a lot of taxpayers. But code section 56, it contains the first part of the definition, house, apartment, condominium, townhouse, mobile home, period. Doesn't give you that alternative. And some of those are, I just recently saw taxpayers who bought one of those great big old motorhomes, $100,000 or more, and they financed it. So, of course, we want to call that a second home. But for purposes of Schedule A, fine, but not for purposes of 6251. I have to say, whenever I talk about RVs, motorhomes, my brain just goes south, and I've seen it. You know, these clients, I don't know how this is going to work out for them. Because these are clients who just recently retired, you know, and both of them had very high-level jobs. They, you know, they had no hobbies. They barely saw each other over the course of the last 30 years because of their jobs. And now they're going to lock themselves into a tin can and drive the freeways of the USA. It doesn't sound like it's going to end well, as far as I can tell. But anyway, I just don't understand the motorhome idea, but there you are. All right, debt repayment. Now, this is where 163 is very favorable when it comes to the tracing rules, is that it basically says you're going to pay off the worst debt first. Even if it's one loan and you're making principal and interest payments, one principal and interest payment every month on the one loan, do I have to allocate the principal? No, I don't. In fact, I will not prorata. I will actually specifically allocate 100% of every principal payment to the worst part of that debt first. So that is your client who's gotten, who's, you know, I don't know, used their house like an ATM. And not only have they blown through their acquisition debt and their $100,000 of equity debt, but they've borrowed over and above that. So some of that debt is not deductible. I'm going to be reducing it first. Or it is the client, especially in this area, who financed $1.2 million to buy their house. I can currently only deduct the interest on 1.1, but every principal payment is going to reduce top down so that I can get closer and closer to that 1.1 that is then fully deductible. So that's the way the tracing rules do work. It allows me least favorable to most favorable first. Page 22, just a few special situations when it comes to 163 and financing your house. Late charges are interest, so they are deductible within the mortgage debt limitation. Prepayment penalties are also interest and deductible within the debt limits. Points, well, points are points, and the default on points is they are prepaid interest, and prepayments for cash basis taxpayers are not allowed. I would have to amortize them over the life of the loan, except if they are the points on my acquisition debt. Then I do get to deduct those all in the year in which they are paid. Now, a couple of other things in here, what happens to mortgage debt in the case of a divorce. One of the other things that I was thinking about, and I haven't yet written the section on it, although from time to time they pop up, they get more popular. And so I don't actually have it included in your materials because I haven't written the section on reverse mortgages. And the key factor there to be careful of on a reverse mortgage is that technically, as long as the underlying debt itself is within the mortgage interest guidelines, even though all the interest is not going to be paid until the very end, when the taxpayer either dies or moves out of the house permanently, it can all be deductible in that particular case. But the one thing that folks often overlook is that for a lot of our older taxpayers who are doing a reverse mortgage, that's only going to be up to $100,000 of the debt. Because before they did the reverse mortgage, they already owned their home free and clear. They had paid off any prior acquisition debt entirely. So the most they can borrow and still have the interest be deductible is $100,000 of equity debt. Yes, sir.
Well, I have a question before that. Did you say if you have a reverse mortgage and interest is accruing,
yep,
can you deduct it?
Yeah, when it's paid. You cannot deduct it as it's accruing. But when the interest is actually paid on a reverse mortgage, which is usually when the taxpayer dies or permanently moves out of the house.
Back to points. My understanding is you can also deduct points in the year that the loan is taken on a refi, if that refi is, if the points are paid and not added to the mortgage balance, and it's the portion to it.
Yeah. So, yes, on points, I can deduct. It's not that I can deduct the points when paid. I can release any amortized points if I refinance and new points are paid out of my pocket or not. But if I refinance, and the key there is I have to refinance with a different lender. If I refinance, there is some... it's not case law, but like private letter rulings from the IRS, that if I refinance with the same lender, and, you know, too often that's what our clients are doing. You know, they're into Chase, and they've been into Chase forever. So their last refinance, we started to amortize their points. They come in and say, I refinanced again. That's great if they refinanced with, I don't know, Ocwen, but if they refinance with Chase, their same lender, I'm going to keep amortizing those old points.
I'm sorry. Say there are no points being amortized on the first loan. You have a brand new refinance loan. Let's say you pull $100,000 out, but it's going to be all for the improvement of your home.
Oh, yeah, if it's a home improvement loan. So I got a new loan that's a home improvement loan, and I'm paying points on it. Yeah, as long as that's going to fit the acquisition debt rule. So it doesn't have to be the purchase money, anything that meets the acquisition debt rule. As long as I paid and didn't finance the points, exactly. You bet. All righty. So that's interest. Now, with one more sort of final thing on interest, starting on page 23, just before we round out financing our house. Remember Mom, where we started this whole discussion of buying the house? Mom came in. Mom's my client. She wants to help little Johnny buy his first house. And remember I said one of the things I need to do when she comes in and says, I'm looking to help little Johnny buy his first house, I need to start framing that of what does she really mean by that? Does she mean, and we decided early on, that she meant she wanted to help him with the down payment, because he didn't have down payment money. But let's just say that little Johnny is not fresh out of school. Little Johnny went to work and he got out of school, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, and oh gosh, he went to work as an engineer for Facebook, and they gave him stock options, and all of a sudden, he's got down payment money, but once he hit the stock option lottery, and got the down payment money, well, he decided he didn't want to work that hard. So maybe he's got not enough revenue to actually qualify for the mortgage itself. So the question Mom is asking about helping little Johnny buy his house is really about, no, I'm going to loan him the money. He's going to make his own down payment, but I'm going to be his mortgage holder. And so the first thing that I always need to identify when it comes to that is this is a loan between relatives. The other problem that where this often rears its ugly head in my practice is a loan from a shareholder to his own closely held corporation. In both of these particular cases, I have to ask a series of questions that my client is not going to be happy with. First question, okay, you're loaning your son the money. You're loaning your corporation some money. Can I see a copy of the note? Yeah. And you, the most often heard answer there is, yeah, we're getting around to that. Yeah, and when did you actually give him the money? And you're getting around to drafting a note? Oh, get around faster. Because by the way, when it comes to these kinds of related party transactions that my client wants to call a loan, if it's to a related party, be it a relative or their own closely held corporation, the IRS has a different view of what that is. And it's not a loan. It's a gift. And so we want documentation that shows that there's a real expectation of repayment, a schedule for that repayment, and all the terms and conditions for the borrower. Now, in the case of Johnny and Mom, we want to encourage them to do that as well, because not only do we want a note, but we want a deed of trust. We want collateral, because that's what's going to allow little Johnny to deduct those mortgage payments that he's paying mom. And mom says, oh, I'm not worried about deduction because, here's the other most often heard phrase, I'm not charging him any interest. What do you mean you're not charging him any interest? Well, if he could afford to pay me interest, I wouldn't have to loan him the money anyway. Bad answer, by the way, because that's the below market rate rules and the imputed interest rules. The imputed interest rules say, I don't care whether they're related to me or not. If I loan you money and choose not to charge an actual interest rate, then the assumption in the law is that I did charge you an actual interest rate, at least as much as the applicable federal rate, and I made you a gift of that interest, and you turned around and paid it to me. And if I got paid interest under that whole grand scenario, I've got taxable income for that interest income. I got not one red cent from you, and I have taxable income. That's the imputed interest rules. So, by the way, no zero interest. We need to actually charge the applicable federal rates, depending upon the term of the loan, are so low. And by the way, for mom, I'm going to tell her, you know what, draft a note, put a real interest rate in it that's at least tied to the AFRs. It doesn't mean Johnny actually has to pay you yet. You know, he can accrue and make you payments later. But as long as you are charging and there's a reasonable expectation that you will be paid later, then, in fact, it's a legitimate loan and we don't have imputed interest. Now, there are a couple of exceptions to the imputed interest rules. The biggest one is what is known as the $100,000 gift loan under the law. I can make a loan, document it as a loan, I expect the $100,000 back, document a loan up to $100,000 and in fact charge zero interest without being subject to imputed interest income. But there's a condition on that. I avoid imputed interest income so long as the borrower does not have more than $1,000 of other investment income. So it's tied to the borrower not having investment income up to more than $1,000. I charge zero. I don't have imputed interest income. Now, that perfectly works actually for most of our corporations because they don't have any investment income, so our shareholders. But mom also claims that this worked. Mom says, oh, that's going to work with little Johnny and Susie, because you know, if they had investment income, I wouldn't have had to loan them the money. They don't have. Now, the problem with that is taking mom's word for that, because mom is my client. Johnny and Susie are not my client. So taking her word for it and basing her tax return on the unknown or her attestation that Johnny does not have any other investment income is not a good idea. I ran afoul of this once because not only was Johnny not my client, mom's little darling son, there was somebody else in the mix that was also not my client. And that was mom's mother and father, Johnny's grandma and grandpa. And Johnny's grandma and grandpa, who were also not my clients, a few years back had done some advanced estate planning, and they'd set up a family limited liability company. And by the way, they just bypassed their children, so mom didn't know anything about it. Grandma and grandpa set up a family limited liability company, and they were gifting membership interests in the family LLC to their grandchildren, including little Johnny. Now, little Johnny has an interest in this family LLC. By the way, he doesn't get anything from that family LLC every year, except a K-1. And that K-1 actually shows investment income of over $1,000. He's not getting the money. He's just getting the K-1 and reporting it on his tax returns. If the borrower does have investment income over $1,000, then if you're charging zero interest rate, you will have imputed interest income up to the excess over $1,000 or the applicable rate, whichever is lower. So it's just about making sure you know all the players in the strategy before you go the zero interest loan. But I have used this one very effectively with some clients who do want to loan to their children and not charge them any interest. All right, we bought it, we financed it, now we're gonna sell it. But it is just about 10 after 10, so it's time for your morning break. So if you'll take a 10-minute break, come back at 10:20. We'll pick it up right here with selling the residence. Take a break.